And for those of you who have been with us all semester, I thank you for making us part of your Thursday routine. Even though today's talk is the last of the regular Thursday talks, I do want to announce two upcoming events not related to the series. But tomorrow, Milan Hauner, who is an honorary fellow in the Department of History, will be giving a talk at Archaeology on a personal journey to Central Asia after a quarter of a century. That's tomorrow at noon in room 5230, Social Science. And then next Wednesday, the 14th, from 4 to 5 in this room, Danielle Frazier, who's finishing her master's thesis in Russian, East European, and Central Asian studies, will be presenting her research. The topic is The Knight and the Beast, Hardening of Serb Identity in Nazi Prison Camps. And we have flyers of both of these events in the back of the room. The next time we'll be meeting for the Krika talks will be in January 19th, with Tim Fry of Columbia University. So stay tuned for more announcements about that. I do ask everyone to please sign in. We need this information for university catering payment rules. And if you're not already on our mailing list, please give us your contact information so that we can reach out to you now that that's out of the way. Delighted that we're closing out the fall 2016 semester with a talk by Yuval Weber. Professor Weber is visiting assistant professor in the government department at Harvard University and a Catherine W. and Shelby Cullum Davis Fellow at the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. And he's also an associate professor at the National Research University, the Higher School of Economics in Moscow, in the Faculty of World Economy and International Affairs. He joined the faculty after completing his dissertation at the University of Texas. The dissertation was titled Petropolitics and Foreign Policy, Fiscal and Institutional Origins of Soviet and Russian Foreign Policy. That was in August of 2014. Dr. Weber has also served as a researcher at the Carnegie Moscow Center and the New Economics School. He's working on a project on the sources of liberal and anti-liberal dissatisfaction for powers in the international system and the strategies they employ to stake their claims for revising the international order. And his talk today is on post-Soviet lustration and contemporary hierarchical relations with Russia. So please offer a warm Wisconsin welcome to you all.
So thank you all very much for coming. And first of all, I'd also like to thank Joey Herrera and Jennifer and Janelle for inviting me to Wisconsin. This is not my first time to the state, but the only time I've been here is to go see a Brewers game. So this is, I consider, my real first time here. And everyone has been super friendly, so this has been really great. I'd say, even though I'm being recorded right here, a welcome change from Cambridge in terms of the friendliness. So as Jennifer mentioned, I'll be speaking today about lustration. And sort of what Joey told me ahead of time is that there are people from sort of all different disciplines, as well as from outside sort of from the community itself. So hopefully this will be of interest to political scientists, but it won't be too esoteric for those who are not familiar with the literature. And so in terms of the introduction and the plan here, first I'll give you really what is sort of like the most important part of the presentation itself in terms of the theoretical innovation. It's to provide a framework of how to integrate domestic and international politics. Within political science, there is a very clear dividing line. Those who study international relations, those who study comparative politics, and they meet for coffee every so often. So what I'll first do is provide a way of thinking about how to put these two things together. Then, put here from Cold War to post the Bielorussia sovereignty. And for the history buffs in the audience today, today's the 25th anniversary of the accords reached by Presidents Shushkevich, Kravchuk, and Yeltsin in Belarus a quarter century ago. And those gentlemen, plus Anatoly Kozyrev, obviously not Yeltsin, but Kozyrev and Gennady Burbulis, just gave a talk at ACES as well as at Cambridge. And they told many, many interesting stories about those days. So once we have a framework, once we have sort of this idea of sovereignty, and an example of how to use the framework, I'll then go to the actual question of what I'm researching right now. And this talk that you're going to enjoy in over the next 45 minutes is basically one chapter of a book I'm working on right now. And I'll describe what extent lustration, which is sort of just getting rid of quote-unquote bad guys, and decommunization, sort of getting rid of the symbols of the bad guys, as it were, how does that affect hierarch-subordinate relationships, i.e. from Russia to all these post-Soviet countries. And what you'll see is I'll use transitional justice as a foreign policy issue. So how does it affect a hierarch-subordinate relationship between post-Soviet states and Russia? Then I'll give you sort of like what is the basic talk, which is the end of the Soviet Union, transitional justice, as Samuel Huntington called it, the torture problem. What do you do with all these people who are now, for one reason or another, less acceptable in the new regime? Then we'll talk about the Soviet Union falls apart. Each state, each 15 of the former republics, has to figure out what is our lustration policy. So we have this exogenous event, we have policy choice variation, and then I'll look at what are the dependent variables, what are the outcomes. And I will define for you political and economic hierarchy, and then show how changes in lustration affect the amount of the hierarch-subordinate relationship today. So two framing assumptions. For those from the international relations subfield, this is all very well known. But basically, what I say here is two large wars, two big assumptions, and the rest of it sort of explains itself. Large wars create international order through settlements between the remaining great powers. That's in a sense the point of war. Countries fight; the winners get to dictate the rules. John Eikenberry's 2001 After Victory is a source of that. And great powers limit sovereignty of others through relational contracting, creating hierarchical relations. The reason that hierarchical relations comes up in the title and right now is to distinguish between the usual assumption of anarchy in international relations, in which all states are sort of these like units, and hierarchy, that the only countries that in a sense enjoy anarchy are those great powers who are able to set the rules. And so the project I'm working on that Jennifer introduced in terms of great power dissatisfaction, the way that I sort of describe dissatisfaction doesn't come up in this talk very much, but sort of the underlying thinking is powers want to change the rules of international order or carve out exceptions for themselves. They want to do so, they're prevented from doing so. That's the dissatisfaction. And in some circumstances, states actually do something about it. And that's where we go from dissatisfaction to revision. But here, we have wars lead to settlements. Settlements basically tell you who's left. Great powers limit the sovereignty of those smaller than them. And Stephen Krasner's Organized Hypocrisy and David Lake's Hierarchy in International Relations are the citations there. And so the settlement of the last big war, and here these are the outcomes of the Napoleonic War, the Crimean War, World War I, World War II, and obviously what we'll get to today is the Cold War. It determines the relations between great powers. It determines the relations between great powers and their client states. And it also determines the preferences of populations within great powers to fund foreign policy and national defense. So this is, in essence, what I think about when I think about these three contracts. And what it says, for those maybe sitting back can't see, how do you preserve international settlements? That which is reached by great powers, you prevent changes of power. And so the underlying thing, what I want you to, you know, at least trust in me right now, is you have an external bargain amongst great powers. You have an external bargain, i.e. this sphere of influence, this hierarchy down below. And you have this state-society fiscal contract within the great powers. If there's a change in any one of those, well, that alters the distribution of benefits in the other contracts. So basically, change in one place leads to change in others. So just to demonstrate how this works in terms of the paper that's behind this and the chapter that's behind this, we can go through what is the Cold War in this style of thinking. So in a sense, each side during the Cold War, 47 to 89, from Truman Doctrine to the Malta Summit, each side is willing to fund military capabilities and diplomatic commitments. So US, USSR, they figure out what are the rules of the road. That's the Cold War itself. Western socialist blocs, those are the hierarchical relations, US with its allies, USSR with its allies, and then the publics. You know, people hiding under the desk, people willing to pay taxes for military affairs, that's what's on that side. And so to go through each of these one by one, just to sort of give you the sense of where I'm coming from, this external bargain number one, this is split Germany. That's how are we gonna split power amongst us? We'll take this big country, we're afraid that the next side who gets Germany on their side as their ally, that's gonna win the next war. So we'll just split it down the middle, or effectively down the middle, and we'll carve out that's your spot, that's our spot, etc. In terms of creating hierarchical relations, whatever the weather, we must move together, this advertisement for the Marshall Plan. And here, the European Recovery Project, you hold the key. So, the United States supports its allies. And in terms of what's happening on the other side, this is for the Comic-Con, Soyuz Zaima Pomoshia, the Council of Mutual Economic Affairs or Assistance, and Mir Druzhba Sozidanie, so peace, friendship, and building, so the economic portion, as well as the Warsaw Pact, the Union of Peace and Socialism. But in a sense, it all comes to, and so the Cold War comes to an end, Malta in 1989. We're all familiar with the events of, or sort of the basic story with that. Mikhail Gorbachev recognizes the domestic internal situation is not going well. Let me change that. Let me make the economy better. Well, part of that is we will revise our contract, our obligations to these Warsaw Pact allies. And part of that is we will revise what is the great power contract itself. Of course, for Mr. Gorbachev, you change one too many things at the same time, and the ease with which the external empire, places like Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, etc., the ease with which they went, with which the Soviet Union was able to give that up, sort of helps catalyze, in a certain sense, those within the Soviet Union who are also looking to exit the country. And so, whereas Gorbachev is very happy speaking with President George H.W. Bush, a year later, not so happy. So that's, in a sense, to think about, there is, Gorbachev wants to make a change in essentially the state-society contract. That creates changes in other contracts, and then it goes out of control. So that's, in a sense, the background, the historical background. I'm sure we're all basically familiar with that. But where we are right now, and why my sort of interest is in transitional justice, is what happens thereafter. This crowd in Estonia, already with a good sense of Western PR, Estonia never joined the USSR. The national colors of Estonia are sort of light sky blue, black and white. Most of the crowd is in that colors. Estonia leaves as quickly as possible, as does their neighbors, the Latvians, taking down. So there is in Ukraine right now this new word, Leninpad. So from Padat to fall, and so taking down all these Lenin statues and so forth. This is Riga during that time. And so Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, they're all trying to get out. Moldova, curiously enough, in a sense, also leads to transitional justice. Because of the war that emerges, and these are Russian soldiers and local separatists heading to the Dniester River, Moldova is split into two parts. And it has what is today a frozen conflict. And the sign here, Tiraspol, Stolitsa Pridnestrovya. So the Transdniester is basically its own thing. And so within Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, as I'll explain in a second, lots of individuals get lustrated. And lustration in this sense means prohibited from government employment or prohibited from running for office. And Moldova, in a curious sense, also inadvertently does a huge lustration program. Because if you are for the Moldovan part of the country, you live in Moldova. If you're interested in closer connections to Russia, or you have served Soviet power, you actually live in the other part of Moldova. So amongst the countries that we'll get into, the Baltic countries plus Moldova essentially choose this very dramatic, very deep lustration policy immediately. Later, I'll talk about Ukraine and Georgia trying to do lustration, but years after the fact. So in a general sense, we should all be on the same page. Are there any questions so far? Okay. So this is where we really get down to the idea of what is exactly transitional justice, and how can we start thinking about it in a way that helps us think about post-Soviet relations today. Transitional justice, in this sense, could be lots of different things. These are not definitive examples, but things that we might all be familiar with. War crimes tribunals, like Nuremberg trials, truth and reconciliation commissions. I remember Desmond Tutu, that's where he became most internationally famous. Reparations, following World War II, West Germany sent a lot of money to Israel. And my family is actually a recipient of that. My grandfather, he lost nearly the entirety of his family. At a certain point, the Bundesbank sent a check. Memorials, Solovetsky Stone, which is on Lubyanka Square in Moscow. Criminal prosecutions, Charles Taylor, Slobodan Milosevic. Transitional justice can go in many different ways. And the practice of, you know, from the United Nations, as well as NGOs, as well as the academic literature on it, says that there are three basic things that transitional justice should do. You should prosecute the very worst people, people with name brand recognition, effectively. Recognize the suffering and the violated human rights of the victims. And that's usually what they focus on. How do you bring the society together? And so achieve historical reconciliation and move on. So this is what the basic literature says. Yet what do we do about the quote-unquote bad guys? To what extent should lustration expose and sometimes remove those in between the leaders and the victims? Or decommunization, get rid of the symbols? To what extent should that go? Should you literally get rid of every single person who is associated with the old regime? Should you get rid of zero people? Between zero and one, there are a lot of choices that you can make. So the literature of transitional justice and human rights, they're all very similar. Limit lustration, focus on symbolism, create new human rights-oriented institutions. As we'll see, this is the institutionalist bias of the past quarter century, several decades. This is how they address it right now. Samuel Huntington, he called this the torture problem. Forgive, but do not forget. Pursue once, and this is 1992, is the third wave of democratization book. It says, forgive, but do not forget. Pursue it once, conduct it immediately, limit the extent, because if you violate any of these prescriptions from above, you will run counter to the goal of democratic regime consolidation. And this is, in terms of the transition, sacrifice lustration. Make the deal with the people who are going to be the targets of it. For their acquiescence, for their silence, the eye on the big prize, eye on the prize, has got to be regime consolidation. And Monica Nalepa, in her book called Skeletons in the Closet, basically when it comes to lustration, do as much as you can, except if it reveals your own culpability in what the previous regime did. And in her book, one of the ways that she explains why was lustration in Central and Eastern Europe, why did it sort of start very dramatically and then peter out? In terms of the transition itself, the people who were these new democratic politicians and so forth, they got into negotiations with the communist authorities, and the communist authorities let them know that there may or may not be some turncoats in your crowd. So the more extensive you want this lustration to be, the greater the chance that you might expose that your dear friends, like my dear friends Yo and Scott, maybe these are the ones who are informing on me the whole time. So in order to,
yeah.
So by the way, the Chorin Spisok that you all signed, I will know. And so in, so if you don't want to reveal who did what, well then that you limit lustration. So these are the basic sort of views. Limited in general, limited with the goal of consolidation, and limited with the goal of self-preservation. So here's where we get to maybe the differences within the post-Soviet, so the post-communist, post-Soviet. So in essence, the literature which I just described to you, they all say in one way or another, reflecting the institutional bias of, you know, Douglas North, Kathleen Thielen, James Mahoney, Huntington as well, you build good institutions. You build sort of these human rights-oriented institutions. You use lustration as an opportunity to build good institutions, so forth. And from that, once you create better rules, you'll get better outcomes. So for those of you who maybe spent too much time at Harvard, trigger warning, picture of Huntington coming up. There is a difference of how the lustration process went in the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union. So in terms of, so the end of the USSR was an exogenous event. 15 republics had to choose their level of lustration. If curious, I also have written about debathification, sort of lustration beyond sort of the post-Soviet case, so I can also answer questions on that. And with a co-author, who's a my father, who's a game theorist, we're working on a formal paper in which we sort of try to solve for what is the optimum level of lustration. And in that, what we argue in that paper is, if there's a trade-off between sort of economic efficiency and sort of interior justice, you can solve that essentially that only so far as you don't wreck the economy, you hold on, you get rid of all the people that you want. But if you introduce the ability of individuals to rebel, then the amount of lustration should be limited. And this came out of a paper I wrote on debathification and denazification. And in that, we're all more or less familiar with debathification, but denazification, at the very end of it, the number of individuals who were banned from lifetime employment after World War II, after the concentration camps, after everything, less than 300 people. And in fact, the only people who were truly under sort of surveillance the rest of their life, whole thing, 80 people. So at the very end, if you get rid of these huge institutions, there may be consequences. But turning back to the region of interest here, within Central Eastern Europe, the idea of lustration is we have to identify all these former spooks, these spies, secret police people. We want to make sure that these people who have demonstrated their inability to essentially behave in a democratic fashion, we've bounced them. But in the former USSR, here's where we get to the big difference. Lustration and decommunization actually come together. And this entire process of transitional justice, it's not just, you know, the Russians go home, whereas like in a place like Czechoslovakia. Here, the Russians still live there. So in the former USSR, this process of transitional justice becomes, as I'll show you, designed to remove those who served Soviet power and to blend lustration and decommunization. So contrary to the literature and to international recommended practices, certain post-Soviet states, which I identified before, they melded lustration and decommunization to create a foreign policy issue with Russia and to distance themselves from Russia. And so in sort of the more formal language, these states engage in conceptual stretching of transitional justice terms to satisfy societal concerns and to revise the hierarchy subordinate contract between themselves and Russia. So when I was showing you that triangle of these interlocking contracts, when it's hierarchy subordinate, that was at the bottom left, between Soviet Union and one of its republics, there's no contract, it's part of that country. But when you think of all these former post-Soviet states, some of them wanted to get as far away as humanly possible, but you know, geography limited how far you can move a country. But in a general sense, this is revising that contract. How is our relationship to Russia defined going forward? And so what these countries did is, as I said, you know, usual advice to transition countries, you build good institutions, you get good policies. Fish and Abrams, they introduced the term political capitalists. Political capitalists, and they go over the case of Estonia itself. In Estonia, they just got rid of everyone. Anyone, and also, so they got rid of everyone who was associated with the Soviet times. By removing these political capitalists, they removed those who served Soviet power, and they removed those who had connections to the political economy of Russia itself. And so by literally, I use this phrase very carefully, physically excluding people from any access to power itself. Fish and Abrams argue that was what created the space necessary to create effective institutions, and that's what created the good policy loop. So in terms of lustration decommunization, what Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, they engage in what we would observe, what we would call today, these massive human rights violations of those Russians there. So they imposed lustration laws prohibiting government employment and right to seek office to Communist Party officials, KGB officials, career military officers, those who participated in Soviet and Nazi repression. That, there wasn't too much of a concern. Some issues of labor law, but those weren't too bad. But they also denied citizenship rights to ethnic Russians. Lustration for those who actually were in government or associated with government, denial of citizenship rights to everyone else who essentially could be an opponent to the democratic transition. And so one of the things that I looked at is who are these actual individuals who are being lustrated itself? You hear about the Russians being denied citizenship rights. When I found the names of those who are actually lustrated, it was ethnic Estonians, ethnic Latvians, ethnic Lithuanians. They were able to figure out or sort of identify who among us was previously on essentially like the Russian team, who was on the Soviet team. Those are the people they lustrated. Those are the people they prohibited from government employment, political office. And for sort of the Russians writ large, because Estonia and Latvia at this time, Russians are about 40 to 45% of the population. The fear of the people who are drafting up these laws and these policies is the reform that we need to do is going to be difficult. And as soon as something goes wrong, the Russians are going to vote us out. There's going to be people against us from our own community. You know, that's what democracy is. But the Russians will be against everything. So we've got to exclude all of them. And in Moldova, because of the frozen conflict and essentially the sorting of the country, they lustrated and decommunized the entire non-Transnistrian portion of the country. So getting rid of people, getting rid of connection to Russia, happened in one fell swoop here. That's early. Later on, Georgia had this freedom charter with the same style of program. Followed the 2008 war, so Russia had already did what was going to happen. Only one person has been lustrated so far, and his case was dismissed. Ukraine, different story. They've already lustrated almost 3,000 people from government service. And this is a fact, you know, part of the source of the war today. As I put here, the lustration decommunization demands generate a commitment problem by the new government to essentially these people in the east of the country, as well as to their protectors in Russia. And so you can think of, if you are in Donbass over the past 25 years, having had previous service in the Soviet government, having these connections to the Russian political economy, these are actually good things. If your economy and your exports are oriented towards this country, then having connections is a good thing. That's how business works. Like I know Yoi knows Scott, she introduces Scott to me. So like, that's how we become friends. And so in 2014, people are now being banned from government service, as well as having the symbols that they enjoy, retroactively the cause of their inability to serve in government. And at the same time, this particular law also put in anti-corruption effects. So Nazi period and Soviet period and corruption all come into one. And so if you are the ostensible target of this, how can, and this is the, and so at the very beginning of the talk, there was an old guy, he had lustration, lustracja in Ukrainian language. If you are in, you know, Lugansk or Luhansk, and you see this sign, you know that they're coming for you. This is, that's the deal there. And then Kyrgyzstan, sort of its own case, it goes back and forth. We can get into it in the question and answer period. And then lustration decommunization, that's everybody else. It just doesn't happen. The people who serve Soviet power, ethnic Russians, obviously in Russia there are plenty of ethnic Russians, but these people who had a connection to the previous regime, these are the ones who stay. These are the countries that essentially now, as we'll see, have a much greater connection to contemporary Russia. And so in terms of transitional justice and hierarchy outcomes, and I'm welcome to sort of, because I'm working through process tracing these cases, but if someone has sort of great ideas on how to measure between this cause and effect, I'm very open to hearing it. In terms of these outcomes, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Moldova joined European political structures, or they're close. And I realize that there's, you know, sort of overdetermined, there's lots of reasons why these countries sort of tried to join European politics, but part of it was getting rid of people who were going to oppose it. Georgia, Ukraine, Kyrgyzstan, trying to join European structures to, you know, to some extent, and the rest not trying to join European structures. So when I talk about hierarchy, I don't use it in any pejorative sense, but as I mentioned earlier, just in opposition to the assumption of anarchy. And I assume that sovereignty itself is divisible. So in terms of measuring political hierarchy, from David Lake's work that I mentioned earlier, I look at foreign troop deployments, and then I look at United Nations General Assembly voting. It's one of the few venues that states can express their foreign policy preferences. And because every resolution in the General Assembly is non-binding. So if it's non-binding, that's essentially where you can be sincere. So I look at the absolute value of ideal points to measure political distance between country A and country B, which is Russia and whichever other country. And then in terms of measuring economic hierarchy, I look at trade dependence, again from Lake. And here, the trade dependence is a country's total trade with Russia divided by its own GDP minus similar ratios for the other permanent members of the United Nations Security Council. And whereas Lake looked at monetary policy autonomy or dependence, Russia got rid of that in 1993. So instead I substituted remittance sensitivity. So as a percentage of GDP, how much money is coming from Russia to the target country? In the interest of time, I'll just give you the results right here. Belarus, Armenia, Tajikistan are the most dependent. And this, Belarus is mostly trade, Armenia sort of trade and remittances. Tajikistan usually gets about 20 to 30% of GDP per year in remittances from Russia. So that's what their source of subordination to Russia. Central Asia and Western USSR countries, you know, the Baltics plus Ukraine, Moldova, these are the least dependent. And one sort of interesting thing that I may have when I was looking at the actual data, the trade data between Central Asia and its partners, it's quite clear that the region is in fact stopping post-Soviet about 10 years ago. And we should probably all just think of Central Asia as pre-China. The trade data and remittance data, it's clear. There's the train left the station a while ago. United Nations General Assembly voting, and the way that Bailey, Strezhnev, and Voitin, the way they coded ideology is the more liberal, the higher the number. The less liberal, the lower the number. And liberal, they describe essentially preferences for the individual versus preferences for the collective. That's the basic liberal, non-liberal distinction. So the UN average in green right here, so you can imagine from 1946, from the founding, it's a bit more liberal than on average, but essentially is around zero this whole time, as one could imagine. The United States well, at least until 2012, and who knows what happens from 2017 onwards, has generally become very liberal over the years. And the Soviet Union was quite sort of anti-liberal in one sense, you know, in favor of the collective. But as the economic situation within Soviet Union worsened, it starts to go up. And by the time we get to 1993, which obviously at the time that, you know, newly independent Russia needs the most help from the United States and its Western allies, that's where Russia reaches the closest between the United States and itself. So how does it look in terms of these lustration states? At the very beginning in 1994, there is quite clear, most countries are figuring out how to get as far away from Russia as possible, even when United Nations General Assembly voting, there's no actual consequences for it. But to demonstrate this political distance, to demonstrate distinctiveness of foreign policy preferences, within the course of the 1990s, they found themselves as far away as possible. The one that sort of goes out right here, one that goes right here, this is Ukraine. And so this is the beginnings of the Orange Revolution and so forth. And so they join. And so this is the Yanukovych years, where it declines and becomes closer. And there's that. And so this is as Ukraine sort of, this is like pre-Maidan, coming closer to the EU. What does this look like in terms of no lustration states? Besides Turkmenistan, which is again its own story, all these countries are getting closer and closer to, essentially keep much closer to Russia. In terms of troop deployments, all the countries that are in the Collective Security Treaty Organization, they have Russian troops on their territory. And the reason troops are important is, you know, in a sense, you should be able to defend your own country. And so when you accept the troops of a foreign country, that is a limitation of your sovereignty. Those countries in NATO have zero Russian troops. Those countries which are outside any alliance also have zero troops. And then in the spicier portion of the table here, Ukraine, the most reliable estimates is there are now about 7,500 Russian troops there. Obviously, this is part of the war. Transnistria, not a country, but they have 1,500 troops. Abkhazia, also not a country, has 4,000. Crimea, yes, I understand there's some difference of opinion on the issue. They have 41,000 troops right now. South Ossetia, 4,000. And Azerbaijan, which has a treaty commitment with Turkey, has zero troops. And so not part of the actual sort of definition that I use, but just in terms of demonstrating what are the outcomes going forth in terms of creating this hierarchy. One of the issues, so here are the polity scores of the lustration states. Kyrgyzstan, this is the Rose Revolution right here. Russia is in this light color. And so these other countries are, generally speaking, more democratic. And so the reason that I put polity scores here as something to demonstrate is that why do states want, what do they want out of their subordinate states? If you're a hierarch, you want states that are politically similar to yourself, because you can then have a social contract with that state in terms of you have a better expectation of what are the benefits that are going to flow upwards, as well as the obligations that flow downwards, reverse. And so what states want is when you're creating these allies, you're creating these hierarchical states, these hierarchical relationships, you want states that look like your own. When we get to the no lustration states, these are states which are more autocratic than Russia itself. Russia is obviously the same. Armenia is effectively like Russia. Everyone else is more authoritarian. And so part of, obviously, what is it that Russia wants out of states which are allied to it? You know, this is the fear of color revolutions. This is the fear of regime change. They want states which are more alike to them than not. So in terms of reestablishing Russian hierarchy, These early lustration states removed or barred those with connections to Soviet power and post-Soviet political economy. They have higher polity scores. Their General Assembly ideal points are further away. They do not have military ties. They joined or are joining alternative blocs. And where we are today with Georgia and Ukraine in particular, late lustration states tried to do the same, but the Russian response has been more forceful. So the post-Cold War era, I'd argue, has actually come to an end. From November 1989, the spread of liberal democracy, which has occurred over the past just more than a quarter century, has reached a pause, or I think more likely an end, at least for the foreseeable future. The post-World War II era defined the U.S. commitment to international affairs, the Truman Doctrine, yet U.S. foreign policy is now unclear. There's been previous U.S. commitment to traditional values and alliance commitments that have raised costs to breaking peace, they have increased transparency, they've provided outside enforcement, but without that, or sort of lack of clarity on that, states will pursue their own security or concede to regional powers. So the early, late, and non-lustration states obviously face varying fates. And so, in essence, where we are right now, I'd say that in terms of this state-society bargain right here, the U.S. people have now voted three times in a row for a less interventionist role abroad, less muscular role abroad. And that sort of has gone well in. So Obama's sort of retrenchment or underreach, that's what has the domestic source right here. Now it's unclear what the external bargain, what is the exact reach of the United States. And so in turn, the ability of the U.S. to hold on to its allies becomes into question. So I'll finish up right there and, you know, just to say in the same way, if there is a revision of these this bargain right here, for Russia's neighbors, this might be essentially what they feel first. So I was supposed to do 45 minutes, so I will stop right there. Thank you for your attention.
That leaves plenty of time for questions and discussion.
Yes?
So I have a question about your coding of whether or not these countries are committing to European institutions. Mm-hmm. What about the European Court of Human Rights?
So the
which Russia belongs to, which Russia's part of.
So in terms of the, so for the countries which are essentially the heavy lustration states, the West gave them a pass on this, excluding Russian's part. In terms of where Russia is right now, I believe it is withdrawing from it, or in sort of this stage withdrawal from it.
But it's been a part of it for the entire Cold War period.
Yes, it has, and it has been most well known for being the only venue where relatives of persons like killed in Chechen wars, or sort of like in the North Caucasus, have sought redress for either torture or somebody being killed. And Russia has, generally speaking, honored those judgments against it. But in the last, I believe it was several months ago, they signaled their notification of withdrawal. So they've been part of it, but I think with a lot of Russia's international commitments, they're sometimes observed, they're sometimes violated, as the particular tactic requires. So like a lot of things of Russian foreign policy, it changes like quickly enough, depending on what the needs are.
I think the political economy aspects of this are especially interesting, and so sort of thinking about denying citizenship as a form of transitional justice or part of the package or whatever, it's interesting. It's when the Baltics, I guess, which had, I know this is the case in Estonia, I suspect it was the case in the other Baltic states as well, you had Russian residents disproportionately represented in the manufacturing sector. So given that the manufacturing sector was expected to be one of the big losers from the economic transition, cutting those folks out, making it impossible for them to vote against the incumbent government seemed to be an important part of moving towards a different set of economic institutions. And so is that part of the story more generally? Is that the sort of interest in pursuing a particular set of economic policies, is that part of the story for why you see certain types of transitional justice in some countries and other types or less of it in others?
Certainly in the Baltics, not just Estonia, but as well in Latvia and Lithuania. So when I cited Steve Fish's paper, in that particular case of Estonia, but I looked, it was roughly the same in the other ones, they knew who the economic losers were going to be. These people were also Russian. And in terms of looking, what are the reforms that we want to do in terms of getting rid of essentially the Soviet era manufacturing sector, let's get rid of it. Who's going to complain? The people that we're going to exclude from this process. And so that is two for two. And particularly in Estonia, they're shedding few tears as to essentially the fates of these people at this time.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess then there's a question about, is this transitional justice or is this something else? I mean, it seems like it's not really about the crimes of the previous regime so much as it is just the sort of the politics of pursuing a particular set of economic reforms.
So in a general sense, I'd say this is, in the Soviet period, there was literal ethnic cleansing of people. That's not available, for a number of reasons. They want to kill more people. But how do you get the same effect? And denying citizenship rights, which then prevents these sorts of people from getting in government to give their ostensible friends in the manufacturing sector, soft budget constraints, access to the central bank, so on and so forth. Whatever sort of tariff policy that they want. And so in terms of transitional justice itself, that's the thing that sort of I can just state without, that I can just state in this sense. They use these terms in ways to punish their former enemies. The terms as used and the practices as should be from the rest of the literature from the United Nations is to achieve historical reconciliation, sort of generate more human rights where there were few, and that answer is no. We have these goals, we have these desires, and it doesn't matter how we're going to get there. So, the young lady and then gentleman in the back.
I'm very curious about the post-Soviet versus the pre-China.
Is pre-China?
That a push or a pull? Is that China pulling them in, or is that an escape from Soviet sphere into the China sphere that is reached between those countries rather than smaller countries?
So the question is, why do I use the phrase pre-China? Is it push or pull?
Right. Are the people being pushed into that, or is China pulling them in? Are they being pushed out of the Soviet sphere? Or what do they think they're going to get from China that they did not get from the Soviets?
So two things happening simultaneously are the worldwide financial crisis helps crater the Russian economy. So the projection of Russian economic power into this region just declines because the Russian economy is in bad shape. Lots of economies are in bad shape at this time. What the result is that the retail trade, up until a fairly high level of sophistication, gets replaced by Chinese traders almost overnight. So in these countries, everything that you actually buy on the street, in a sense, when looking at like what's being replaced, that gets replaced by China nearly overnight. So Uzbekistan has a bit of sort of Turkish sort of trade coming in, Tajikistan has a bit of Iranian trade coming in, but it's the receding of Russia and the essentially expansion of China. And when these happen together, it becomes even visually noticeable, like even looking at something as dry as like trade statistics. And so there is, as I said, I live right now in Cambridge, Massachusetts, but I've lived for the last couple of years in Russia. And something that I've heard before, when thinking about what is Russia-China relationship, someone once summarized it as following. They provide the money, we'll provide the brains and guts. And that's the Russia-China relationship in terms of what does sort of the great power relationship look like, as well as what happens in Central Asia. That China has all the money, and effectively Russia will cede Central Asia to it in terms of this sort of zero-sum thinking. But where Russia retains the ability to help define that relationship, the CSTO is mainly Russian in terms of military power within the region. And the offer that Russians will very generously make to the Chinese is because the West is very afraid of a rising China, that China can use the diplomatic services of Russia to interface on their behalf with the West at large. So let me get to the gentleman in the back, and the gentleman here, and the gentleman here.
I'm actually from Czechoslovakia, so I just have a quick question for you. Do you feel that the West was prepared for all this transition? Because, I'm not trying to pick on Harvard.
Yeah.
There was a famous Czech student who went to Harvard School of Business called Viktor Kozeny, who actually learned a lot of things about business and everything else, went back to Czechoslovakia, created a Harvard fund, which was a Ponzi scheme, stole lots of money, and now is living in Bahamas, and basically he's scot-free. So I guess the question is, if the West was maybe better prepared to deal with, all of these things, he probably would be living, scot-free in Bahamas right now with a Swiss bank account,
So yeah, that's a larger question, so that's sort of beyond my pay grade to think about that. But in terms of studying this particular era, there was sort of this opportunity. Once the Soviet Union came apart, George H.W. Bush was probably one of our sort of most adept presidents when it comes to diplomacy, and in the memoirs of that era from, not like Mary Lee Surratt has written a lot about this, but sort of like all the policymakers at that time, they were the people there wanted to essentially get involved in essentially the former Soviet space. They wanted to, if not do Marshall Plan Part 2, they wanted to do something of that nature. And really like the decision came down for President Bush or the elder President Bush is, there's a recession that's starting up in the United States. The post-Iraq war shine is coming off fairly quickly. And so between recession and clearly, Bill Clinton's campaign slogan of that time was, it's the economy, stupid. And so what President Bush was facing at this time was a number of congressmen who really wanted the Soviet Union, sort of Russia at this time, they wanted an apology. The Cold War's over, we won, Soviet Union fell apart, you lost. If you want American taxpayer money, there's gotta be a hat, it's gotta be in your hands, and you've gotta apologize for everything that just happened. So that is how prepared was the United States for what happened thereafter. That's essentially the domestic political concerns that George H.W. Bush is facing. How can I justify giving money to Russians, Czechoslovaks, whomever, and taking it away from people at home? Once the Cold War is over, the desire to actually pay for all this sort of stuff, to pay for diplomacy and foreign affairs, that goes down dramatically. George H.W. Bush, the Cold War ended peacefully, Soviet Union ended fairly peacefully, the Gulf War was won, and what good did that do him in the 1992 elections? So in essence, were they prepared? They certainly were thinking about it, but that's a consequence of elections. When Clinton comes in, he has much different concerns. So, sir?
I have a category question about justice here.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the truth and reconciliation thing in South Africa.
Sure.
You mentioned debathization in Iraq.
Yeah.
And you mentioned all of this. Aren't those three tremendously different activities? I mean, South Africa was, to my understanding, was a collective therapy session, right? It was sort of asking people to come and confess and so on. Debathization was a U.S. imposition in Iraq in this post-war period. And this thing that now you're discussing seems like economic opportunities among these countries. So is it all about justice, or is it justice as retribution, or justice as healing? I mean, the South African thing was healing, I think. I'm not sure there's a lot of healing here. It sounds to me like it's retribution. Can you help me understand
so
what
certainly.
You mean by transitional justice?
So this is so when I was bringing up these different types of transitional justice measures, I meant to just demonstrate there's a wide world of what could happen. And it could range. So truth and reconciliation, the underlying problem in South Africa is two communities who know very well in aggregate what has happened.
Yeah.
Can they essentially say it out loud? Collective therapy. Like so that
they know they have to live together going forward.
So in terms of what I think the Baltic countries did is they used the category of transitional justice to exclude their former enemies. And so this is, so that's in essence what is different from the existing literature on transitional justice, because this existing literature is how can we live together in a better way? And there's an example here in which the same words were used to effectively conduct a purge of all your political enemies while using the language of coming together.
That's what I'm talking about.
And so like there is just a there's
what
a wide range.
By justice,
So the justice is idiosyncratically defined in this instance. And there was a question right here.
Just a few words about Russia and non-existent illustration. Russia is again a very unique country, because in all totalitarian and authoritarian countries of the past and present, the political police always was and remained an instrument of power, weapon of power. And in Russia today, it has become the power. Why did this happen? There was very many reasons for this unfortunate development, but I would like to draw your attention back to the few months in the aftermath of the failed 1991 coup. At that time, for a few months, a group, a very small group of the former Soviet dissidents and their supporters had made two demands. First, the names of the KGB officers should be made public, not in order to punish them, but to make it more difficult. They're already noticeable at the time penetration into other foci of power and economic activity. And the second demand, to reveal the names of the former informants, in the Russian colloquial slang, stukachi. Again, it was explained not in order to punish them, though the country should know the names of her heroes, but in order to prevent the possible future blackmail. And these things in this respect were done not by the public, not by the state, by the public. For example, the late editor of the most liberal at that time Russian newspaper, Obshcheye Gazeta, editor-in-chief was Igor Yakovlev, published some documents that Alexei the second at that time patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church, who already began to preach the eternal Russian spiritual superiority, in the recent past was a KGB informant by the name Drozdov. the war geography and prisoner conversations, he told that after his newspaper published these materials, he got a personal telephone call from Yeltsin. He told us, stop it immediately, otherwise even I would not be able to protect you. And who in public opposed the most these demands? It were the so-called New Democrats, like Edgar Popov and a few others. They warned against the non-existent witch hunt. There are many reasons to believe that their Soviet past was far from being blemished. In this regard, the famous Russian writer Vladimir Voinovich remarked that the staunchest opponents of capital punishment are the murderers waiting for an execution. These people had very good reasons to protest against the non-existent again, which had. And the problem is that one should not necessarily punish the witches, but in new society, the witches should be put into the corner. Otherwise, they will start to hunt again. This is just what we're witnessing now in contemporary Russia. So you see, my point is that in such countries, limited frustration or just revealing the names is extremely important. Not punishment, but publication of the names.
No, it's an interesting comment. So lustration, so it's the same root as like luster, to sort of shine light on something, to expose what is there. And in my research on the Russian case, Boris Nikolaevich was quite understood. Should we expose the names? Boris Nikolaevich was...
The Germans did it. They published not only the names of the Stasi officers, mm-hmm. but all collaborators, all informants.
So these Germans were... They effectively are going into West Germany to create their Germany. Like the people who are there to advocate on behalf of Stasi agents are the Soviet people who have a lot bigger fish to fry at home. And Yeltsin at this time is very aware that if he leads essentially the same lustration within the Soviet Union, within essentially post-Soviet Russia, these are countries in which communism had been installed over the past two generations. People could be identified. Within Russia, this is the entire system for 70 years. So this could get out of hand quickly. If it gets out of hand quickly, the regime consolidation, you know, Yeltsin is thinking in this Huntingtonian sense, you know, put the Communist Party on trial, but we'll do that once, and we'll bring it to an end. Because if this goes further, we could have another Smutnaya Vremya. And there could be like a lot of people fighting at this time, a time of troubles. And so if you have another Smutnaya Vremya, who knows where it ends up? So Yeltsin's response wasn't to publicize as many names as possible, but to break up the KGB, the KGB into like different, to separate all the different tasks. What we've actually seen over the past couple months is the beginnings of the plans to bring back the KGB into the MGB. So there's going to be a Ministerstvo Государственной Безопасности, Ministry for State Security, which will bring together investigation, surveillance, foreign intelligence, as well as counterintelligence, all into one organization. So I take the gentleman's sort of comment very seriously, and I think it sort of like goes into line with what we see here.
Then I would add one thing more to your very impressive table. The attitude to the former secret police, whether they were disbanded, like in Czechia or Poland, reformed completely or whatever.
That Russia actually is keeps on electing the biggest KGB agent.
Yeah, so I think.
And he actually started in East Germany.
And
he was based in Germany for a long time, so I mean, he's fluent in many different. I mean, to me, I think it's an insult that Putin makes it look like he doesn't understand English. He understands English. I can guarantee you he does. He just, for some stupid reason, he just wants to make it look like he does, but he does.
So I guess in that, in sort of the, this general sense, the lack of lustration, decommunization, and essentially time period one creates this outcome in time period two. Yoi?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the comments are good in terms of thinking about the goals of what's going on. I mean, it all falls under the title of lustration, but the goals are very different. And I mean, I think going back to Scott's point, or even thinking through Monica and Olympia's argument, and you're sort of making the opposite of, it seems like people are seeking truth and justice, but it might be that they have other instrumental reasons and they just are using that for specific aim. But there are some people that it's not, the lack of lustration in Russia is not because there's a general interest in the process, but for various reasons it's politically impossible. It's a complete lack of interest. I mean, in revelation of the truth of in discussing. Although there are these places where I think it's becoming difficult, like with the memorials of who was killed in various wars, etc., on November 4th. Like, once you start talking about victims and you start saying, like, well, I want to talk about my grandfather who died in World War II, then you're going to end up with the people, well, yes, my grandfather died in World War II, but not in the front, but in gulag, or then this and that happened. I think it's very iffy what's going to happen with it when they keep with this memorializing, and eventually that might allow for some of the historical discussion to get out. But I think it's striking in Russia how little interest there is in actually discussing difficult periods. And now I think there's like a full, like, comprehensive attempt to rewrite history of the 20th century in these nonsensical ways, rewriting World War I. Until I was just talking about rewriting the Decembrists. I mean, the role of the Orthodox Church, like, there's all this nonsense rewriting going on, and none of it is really about revealing truth and healing and all that. It's just like, we want to create a coherent narrative of what's happening. But some of it might end up under this title of lustration, but I guess I think it's worth thinking about. There's a lot of differences going on there. And also in the Central Asia part, I mean, it's interesting on your, I think this is an interesting list. I think I was always a suggestion of looking at positions towards former KGB offices in these countries is interesting. But it's striking all of Central Asia is not involved in that. And why? And their position toward the Soviet past is just completely different from the Baltics. And in Kazakhstan, they are rewriting history there too, but calling everything that's Soviet Kazakh. Like, Baikonur is a Kazakh achievement. Everything about the Soviet Union that they like is, they've Kazakhized the Soviet experience. That this is like, shows how great Kazakhstan is as a country. So it's a different reason, a different kind of approach to the Soviet period. It's not just hiding it, it's not opposing it like in the Baltics, but it's renaming it as Central Asia.
All the Gulag camps on their territory. The Gulag camps.
Yeah.
All they memorialized.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah, there's some tensions in some of the names.
Victims.
Yeah.
Not perpetrators.
Yeah.
Victims.
Yeah.
So certainly transitional justice is used in a lot of these places in an instrumental sense. And what is happening in Russia is how to retrospectively justify, how to rearrange the past to justify the present.
Yes.
And essentially to make the present essentially insufficiently good. And so that if we just keep going down this path, mm-hmm. it'll be even better. Like, that's...
But it's strangely backward looking compared to the Soviets. Like, there's nothing about the future in today's discourse in Russia.
Remember,
it's all about redoing the past.
But the crazy thing is, I mean, even now, Russian politicians want to want the Cold War back. They want to have the USSR back. They want to have Eastern Europe back. I mean, that's what's crazy.
It was a time when everyone was young. Everything was very well known and understood. We were respected as a great power. That sort of nostalgia is very present, sort of as a lived experience in contemporary Moscow, or contemporary Russia.
That's what's kind of crazy. I was like, that's going to maybe lead to another war.
So it was like with the dissertation that Jennifer was describing at the very beginning is, in terms of like what was the political economy of the Soviet Union towards the end, the oil money comes in, and just they're throwing money at diplomatic commitments abroad, military spending, as well as increasing domestic consumption. Like, it disappears at a certain point, and then they're left holding the bag on all these extended commitments just everywhere. And that's what Gorbachev was trying to undo, you know, slowly, but then too quickly. And in terms of looking at today's Russian economy, we're in the same, the Russian policymakers have effectively recreated the 70s and the 80s. And I think in terms of like the interior vibe of my students in Russia, at least one of them once lamented that he'll never be like FSB material because he went to higher school of economics, and that's already the black mark against him. That essentially the university is just too liberal, and that shows bad judgment. Because that's the place where you can really make like, serious money. You can either already come from an oligarch family, or you can get into what Andrei Soldatov has called the new nobility. FSB is a money-making opportunity. And so like the smartest kids go there. So contemporary Russia right now has spent the second windfall of the 2000s. The diplomatic commitments are now in place, and we are in a economic situation in which observing Russia, just even in terms of the published budget that came out last week, they anticipate that all those tens of billions of dollars from the 2000s that went into the reserve fund is over in a year. So end of 2017, end of 2018, the reserve fund that is just like the checking account of the country, dry. They anticipate that it will be spent up. And of the pension fund will also have $15 billion taken from it. And so that's the pensions for the grandmothers. So that we're sort of getting off topic here, but like the long and short of it is the money's gone. And whatever's left will go. And then at the very end of it, I think you know we'll bring back Chernomyrdin's "Ну хотели лучше вышло как всегда." Like we're in the middle of it right now, which is unfortunate for Russians, but so be it.
Okay. Well, I think we can continue the conversation more informally. But thank you for your discussion, and thank you, Dr.
Thanks.
Weber.